Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Martin Troost was born in the Netherlands and has lived and traveled all over the world. His essays have been widely published, and his previously published travel memoirs include the best-selling The Sex Lives of Cannibals. He's with us tonight to help launch his new book, Headhunters on My Doorstep, and tell us how and why he came to follow Robert Louis Stevenson's final journey through the South Seas. Would you please join me in welcoming Martin Troost back to the Tattered Cover?
Thanks, everyone, for coming out, and thanks to the Tattered Cover for hosting me here. It's sort of these days like a good independent bookstore. It's sort of like a monastery back in the Dark Ages, you know. You imagine sort of like, you know, these monks scribbling, you know, copying Aristotle, preserving it, and here we are these days, and at least in these bookstores, there's usually good coffee and some good cookies, too. So you can imagine sort of the monks, hey, Bishop, you know, cookies. Anyway, this is a book just came out today, so this is the first reading I've done, so you'll just have to sort of bear with me. I was trying to figure out what to read, and so I did kind of an amusing diversion. I went on YouTube, and I Googled, like, author readings. It's kind of a low entertainment bar that we've set for ourselves. It's sort of like, you see sort of like kitten videos, 3 million hits, author reading, 12 hits. And you know, it's the author that keeps sort of clicking on it and on it. And my favorite two were sort of like, there was a writer who came around and he started, as soon as he got in, he started taking pictures of everybody. And he says, I'm going to post this on my Facebook. He was sort of excited, and everybody just kind of creeped out. and then there was another guy who I guess had a good audience, and he had people in the back, but so he had everybody in the back come sit in the front below his feet, like on the floor. And I was like, man, these people probably looked at sort of like author readings on YouTube. There's a reason they're standing in the back. They're looking for like their exit strategy, you know. Now you're doing it. And then it kind of made me think, like, it's sort of like David Sedar is sort of such a mutant. You know, I mean, he not only can read, you know, write really well, he can also like talk, you know, like writing and talking for an author is sort of this mutant strange power, sort of, you know. I imagine him sort of, you know, with like Wolverine, you know, he should be part of the X-Men, you know. What's your special power? I do entertaining book readings. Whoa. Anyway, Headhunters on My Doorstep. I like to think of this book as the concluding volume in my South Pacific trilogy, mostly because I really like saying that. Sort of like, you know, there's really a Lord of the Rings dude, and there's the Sex Lives of Cannibals dude. What I did with this book, as maybe some of you may be aware of, not others, is I used to live in the South Pacific. I used to live in Kiribati, and I lived in Vanuatu, and I lived in Fiji, and I wrote about all those places. Kiribati being part of Micronesia, Vanuatu and Fiji being part of Melanesia, and I got to reading Robert Louis Stevenson, and he's always sort of been kind of peripheral to my world. I knew he'd been a creature of the South Pacific, but I never really sort of read him. I thought his books would be like homework. And anyway, I started reading In the South Seas, and I grew absolutely sort of, you know, enraptured with this man and with his travels. And I decided to sort of follow him out. And he was sort of an extraordinary fellow. When he left on the Casco, which is the boat that he chartered in San Francisco, he left San Francisco. He stood about 5'10", weighed all of 95 pounds. So he was not a strong, healthy man. At the time, he was probably the most renowned, most famous writer of his era. And yet, when he left sort of the golden gates of San Francisco, when he left the bay, he would never set foot on a continent again. unless you count Australia, which, you know, let's be honest, is just kind of a big island. And for the next few years, he lived sort of as a vagabond, as a beachcomber, roaming the South Seas. He traveled sort of to all over. And the journey that I followed was the one that he wrote about in the South Seas. So I traveled to, I found a boat that would take me to the Marquesas, and then onwards to the Tuamotus, then to Tahiti, and then I returned to my erstwhile home, Kiribati, and then finally in Samoa. So it was an extraordinary journey. But what I'd like to read is actually a little part about Kiribati, which is where I used to live and perhaps some of you are familiar with. It's a nation of isolated, extremely isolated atolls. And I hadn't been back for more than 10 years, and I was very, very curious about what had changed. So I'm going to read about a trip that I took from Tarawa, which is kind of the main island and was my home and where I lived, to one of the outer islands, Abayang. And then after that, I'd like to just open it up with just to do Q&A, because that's just way more fun, I think, for everybody than just me kind of lecturing. I'll just start from the beginning here. So I was wrong. Much, in fact, has changed in Kiribati since I was here last. Take, for instance, the presence of a sandbar off Naa, the northernmost tip of the island. It wasn't there before. At no point during my years on Tarawa did I recall the existence of a long, elongated sliver of sand extending far to the south, at least a mile, following the contours of a submerged reef, the rim of an undersea volcano that separates the lagoon from the ocean. And now here it was. Over the years, surging tides had extended their reach, scraping off soil that the island could ill afford to lose and depositing it in places where before there was only water. The atoll was in motion, changing with startling rapidity as the ocean toyed with it like a cat fiddling with a mouse. At some point, of course, the mouse would be no more. I found myself on a what exactly? A boat, a sea bus, driftwood, a floating junk pile. It was yellow and it had an engine that coughed and sputtered and strained against the incoming tide. It had two plywood hulls, a squat wheelhouse, and a kind of awning over the weathered deck. In any event, I was on the water, chugging toward Abayang. This was now the only outer island that people could reach by sea. There was once a similar ferry to Mayana, but a year earlier it capsized and sank and 33 people drowned. As we passed through the channel, we were buffeted by lazy swells. Few sights are more visually stunning than that place where the lagoon meets the ocean. There is a riot of color, hues of blue so radiant that you'd swear someone slipped you a tab of acid. And below, just beneath the surface, were clumps of coral and ardent bloom, surrounded by schools of darting fish. I was in the wheelhouse, sharing a bench with a woman nursing an infant. The captain lay sprawled beneath me on the floor, snoozing through the torpor of midday. At the helm was a one-eyed sailor wearing hot pink capri shorts. A gold hoop dangled from his ear. Another crew member offered me a plastic mug of sweetened tea, and I sat contentedly watching the wonderland go by. Stevenson alighted upon Abayang, but did not write about it. Instead, it was Tembanuk, the king of Abamama, who caught his eye. The last tyrant, he wrote of him, the last direct vestige of a dead society. They hadn't meant to land upon Abamama. Ships avoided the island and the terrifying despot who ruled it, but a wind caught their sails and they entered its lagoon. Tembanuk was a gift of the gods for Stevenson, a character so unique, menacing, and charming that you could almost feel the writer's pen lurching across the page, scribbling furiously as he sought to capture every nuance, every detail of the great king. A beaked profile like Dante's in the mask, a mane of long black hair, the eyes brilliant, imperious, and inquiring. Where there are no fashions, none to set them, few to follow them if they were set, and none to criticize, he dresses to his own heart. Now he wears a woman's frock, now a naval uniform, now and more usually figures in a masquerade costume of his own design. The masquerade becomes him admirably. In the woman's frock, he looks ominous and weird beyond belief. A flying fish leapt and soared 100 yards and more. On the bow of the boat, people stirred in the languorous heat, aware suddenly that we had visitors. I moved forward and joined them. We were accompanied by a dozen spinner dolphins, surfing the bow waves, just inches from our noses, as we lay flat, peering over the front of the boat. "You ever eat the dolphin meat?" the man next to me said. "It's very good." "Swim, dolphin, swim," I thought. "Do not lurk here." What did we look like? A whale-watching cruise? You've got the wrong boat. Swim away. But they didn't. And as we crossed the open seas, they tumbled up front like eager scouts on point, blazing a trail across the great depths of the sea. It was a crowded boat, with families clustered on mats in the shade of the awning, finding space amidst crates of canned food and old bicycles, with more people gathered up top, absorbing the full blast of the sun. The crew had cast a couple of fishing lines off the stern of the boat, but when hours passed without a boat, no doubt to the enormous Asian fishing vessels lurking around Tarawa, they pulled the lines back in as we approached the channel into the lagoon at Abayan. A green turtle swam near, and I gave my tattoo an affectionate pat. I got a tattoo in Marquesas. You're not alone, crooked turtle, except he put it on really crooked, so it kind of looks like it's swimming away. The acid really kicked in here, because Abayang's lagoon shimmered with such breathtaking displays of color that even Gauguin's paintings seemed monochromatic and dull in comparison. There was a village on the southernmost tip of the island, and I could see its thatched roof dwellings and manyabas, the meeting houses where the Akiribas congregate for events large and small, and then the atoll marched toward the horizon, a long display of coconut trees and white sandy beaches, and all around turquoise water so dazzling and lustrous that you'd think you'd died and gone to heaven. Except surely God offered a better meal than this. The chase boat was unhooked from its perch on the side of the vessel, and the crew filled it with boxes of fabulous pork luncheon meat, MJ China cabin biscuits, bags of rice, and fruit-flavored bubblegum. And so we moseyed down the length of the atoll, hopscotching from village to village, where people in the grim fare of the islands were unloaded, as local sailing canoes, lean and swift, carried fishermen across the lagoon. Sister Matarana had radioed the Catholic high school on Abayang, and informed them that they'd have a visitor. I hopped off the chase boat in the shallows of the lagoon and waded ashore. The school was like a village. Students from throughout Kiribati boarded here, and I saw them sweeping and transforming a field of coral and scrub into a track, complete with lanes delineated with sand. In a manyaba, a group of teenagers sang one of the old songs, a high-energy number that shook coconut trees and caused the water to ripple. The Kiribati can sing. It's one of those countries. Maybe Jamaica and Mali are comparable, that breathes music. Nearby, there were a number of gravestones announcing that here lay Father Leon Marquis, killed in the Marshall Islands, and Brother Louis Latour, 1875 to 1919, and Sister M. Saint-Pierre, 1874 to 1952, as well as a dozen small unmarked graves that I presumed held the remains of students to have died here. A sister came to fetch me and took me to the kitchen to show me the rainwater tap, while a piglet and a puppy played and wrestled on the floor, and then she marched me to the guest house, which looked like an L-shaped thatched manyaba with beams of coconut timber lashed together with coconut fiber. Inside, there were plywood partitions separating four rooms. Mine had a small wooden bed frame with a foam mattress and a mosquito net. On the wall, there was a picture of Jesus praying. The sister returned a short while later with dinner, fish, rice, breadfruit, both boiled and fried, and bitter green belly mixed with onion, and as I ate, I was briefly joined by the headmaster, a kindly man with hangdog eyes who had once been a ship's captain. "What's the strangest place you've been to?" I asked. "Antarctica on an icebreaker." This made me laugh. An ice cube seemed to challenge the reach of one's imagination on Abayang, never mind an iceberg. Many Kiribati men trained to become seamen, but very few rose through the ranks to become a captain. I asked if he missed it. "It can be difficult to be on land. I miss the sea, but I am a graduate of the school, and when they asked me to come back, I couldn't say no." "What's your biggest headache here?" "The kids," he said with a roll of the eyes. Typical teenage behavior. He needed to attend to his duties, and I stayed up for a short while reading my Kindle with the aid of a flashlight, and then once I turned it off, spent much of the night being feasted upon by ravenous mosquitoes. Somehow, they had managed to find every hole in the netting, and when I finally did fall asleep, I was soon awoken to the clang, clang, clang of the bell rustling everyone up for pre-dawn mass. And that's when I stepped on my Kindle. It was like two worlds colliding. The pre-electric past, wherein there are no light switches to help guide your feet when you're suddenly and noisily awoken, and the whiz-bang gadgetry of the present. Here, the past won. The Kindle gave a desolate croak and could not be roused. Curses, I thought. A real book wouldn't do this to me. I resolved to go back to print until the Brainiacs in Silicon Valley fix this fatal flaw in their hardware. What good is a book if you can't step on it? I hobbled to the manyaba just as mass commenced. The students were in uniform and divided into neat rows, boys on one side, girls on the other. I sat quietly in the back, picking pieces of Kindle out of my foot, and was pleased to discover that the service would be in English. "Life is about living, not dying," said the priest, a stern-faced man with a helmet of black hair and flowing purple robes. "Fair enough," I thought. "We should focus on life, not death." "But what is the meaning of life?" the priest bellowed. I waited with eager expectation. It seemed only right and true that I'd discover the answer during pre-dawn mass on a remote atoll in the South Pacific. "What is it?" the priest repeated. "Yes," I thought, "what is it?" "You don't know?" he suddenly hissed. "No, Father, I don't. What is the meaning of life?" "You really don't know?" he said, his voice dripping with bitterness. "I'm very disappointed in you." And then he sagged into the blessing of the sacrament. "Wait," I thought, "you're not going to tell us? At least offer us a little guidance or a clue or at minimum parable for us to deconstruct. Come on, not even a hint?" But he kept the meaning of life to himself and proceeded on with his blessing of the Eucharist. We responded in English, and as we did so, he lowered the Eucharist and glared at us. "Why do you reply so softly?" he said. "I don't know." It seemed plenty enthusiastic to me, given that the sun hadn't even risen yet, and some of us were plucking shards of plastic out of our feet. "Why," he said, "do you not know the words? Is that it? Is that why you speak so softly? You do not know the words?" His voice echoed off the lagoon, and now there was a long moment of silence. The students shifted uncomfortably, heads down. The few dogs that had been lingering outside the manyaba shuffled off. A rooster's bluster broke the still air. Finally, the priest picked up his chalice and bowl of wafers, lowered his head, and exited the manyaba, striding to the old stone church and disappearing into the nave in whatever dark lair he had constructed for himself. We sat stunned. "First you deny us the meaning of life, and now you march off in a snit with billowing robes, forbidding us a sacrament. I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Father Cranky Pants, but all through the islands there are missionaries, Mormons, Baha'i, Seventh-day Adventists, just looking for disillusioned Catholics. You've got to at least try, don't you think?" "But no, instead you give us the last tyrant storming off in a woman's frock. That just won't do these days. People have options, you know. It's like my Kindle. I have a library's worth of choices." "Oh, that's right. We're back in ye olden days now." Fortunately, the church also has nuns, who, while certain petulant clerics stirred in a sea of resentment, were busy running rehabs, cooking meals, tending to the sick, teaching kids their math lessons, and otherwise cheerfully going about their business of making the world a better place. And you can't fool a nun. Over breakfast of sweet stale bread and expired peanut butter, I watched them happily make mincemeat out of the kids trying to talk their way out of school. "He said he left his books in the village," Sister Tatang said with a smile after dismissing a boy. "He wanted to walk to the village and get it. All day walking to the village, all day walking back from the village. I sent him to class." I explored the island on a bicycle borrowed from the sisters. There is a coral and sand path that follows the length of the atoll next to the lagoon, undisturbed by vehicles since there are but three working trucks on the island and not a single car. In between villages, there are long, serene stretches, and I often stop to have a quick swim. Toilets are mostly unknown on the outer island, so it's best to avoid the beaches near settlements. The sand there is thick and slimy and often fertilized. But away from the villages, and what you find is a beach of such languorous beauty that you can't believe that such a place still exists. Uncorrupted and untainted by tourists, its rhythms as immutable as dawn and dusk. I watch reef herons wade through the shallows of the lagoon, stealthily hunting. Swimming some distance from shore, I was astonished to see that the beach itself was alive. What I had taken as a smattering of inanimate shells and rocks were in fact tribes of crabs, all marching and scurrying as if this were rush hour in Times Square. More serene were the villages themselves, where subsistence living still predominates. Subsistence living, of course, is the technical term for men sitting on their asses all day while the women do all the work. Sure, at some point before nightfall, the men will catch a fish or two, and from time to time they'll build a wooden thatch home or repair a manyaba, but that's pretty much it. Meanwhile, the women are hacking open coconuts and laying them out to dry. They're weaving mats and entwining palm fronds. They cook, tend to the fires, sweep the day's dust and leaves, take care of the kids, and otherwise keep the whole edifice of island society standing upright and firm. I passed a village with the second largest manyaba in Kiribati. Think of an aircraft carrier made from the remains of coconut trees. And another, Koinawa, that offered a cathedral built under the guidance of a Belgian missionary who failed to notice that big stone churches are really uncomfortable on the equator. The exterior is lovely, the interior gutted and ruined. Even Father Cranky Pants recognized the enduring truth of the tropics. It's hot out here, which is why the giant manyaba gets love and tending, and the stone church does not. But I was looking for another village. Antarawa, Sister Matarana, a native of Abayang, had told me about Tembunika. The sea had swept it away, she told me. The people who were out, they came back to find their possessions floating away. The village is located near the northern end of the atoll, a pit of land wide enough to encompass a freshwater lagoon where milkfish once thrived and fed the village. That lagoon was the first to go as it flooded with salt water that soon killed the milkfish and nearby coconut palms. There were once babai pits, sunken depressions where locals cultivated taro, and in a few short years the encroaching ocean turned the waterland so brackish that nothing could grow. As spring tides, or king tides as they're sometimes referred to, began to flood homes, the village picked itself up and moved 50 yards inland. But it wasn't far enough. The ocean continued to surge, lapping at the edge of the village. The inhabitants built seawalls. The ocean tore them down. Finally, as sea levels continued to rise, the village was abandoned and the people dispersed. All that remains of Tembunka today are the ruins of a manyaba and the skeletons of homes surrounded by a great flood of water. It is a haunting sight, and it is different and it is new. This was not the past or the future. This was today, the land receding under the waves. So I'll just stop that there. But I wanted to highlight that one, that part from Kiribati, because the nation's dying. I mean, it will not exist in a generation from now. Already sort of the government of Kiribati is buying land in Fiji. Right now it's to grow food, as they can no longer grow as much food on their own islands as the water becomes more brackish, but eventually to settle. So really what we're looking at with Kiribati, you know, it's a nation that I really am fond of, if, you know, it's been a home of mine, is it's disappearing. It will be no more. So I just thought I'd use this opportunity to sort of shine that little spotlight out there. But I think I'll just stop with the reading from now and just spend the rest of the time taking any and all questions. Hopefully you have some. Yeah.
What is the population of Kiribati?
Right now it's increased somewhat. It's just under 100,000, with most of the population living on Tarawa, and the rest sort of dispersed primarily in the Gilberts and then somewhat in the Phoenix and the Line Islands. The area of Kiribati basically encompasses an area sort of as large as the continental U.S., but the total land mass is smaller than, you know, Baltimore, just sort of divided into 33 parts. And there isn't a lot of land. It's what there is of it, it's an atoll, so the highest point is not more than 2 feet above sea level. Most islands are no more than 100, 200 yards wide. So there's really sort of a no room for error, so to speak. And I don't know if anyone saw the New York Times yesterday, but there was a thing on the front page where scientists now have reached pretty much consensus that in the next 100 years, sea levels are likely to rise 3 feet. And that sinks Kiribati. It's sort of a... It's an interesting... When I was in Abayang, I met a very interesting man. He's a Solomon Islander. And he'd sort of left the Solomons 10 years ago and was now sort of hiding in the islands. He had some turmoil in Solomons, and he was now a teacher there. And he was saying that what he liked about Kiribati, in his own way, is that there's no thinking of tomorrow. There's no thinking of yesterday. There's only today. You take care of your family. If you're fed, you see what pleasure you can get. There is just today. And so I find that sort of the Kiribati themselves, many of them sort of almost have sort of blinders on, but the government is a lot different. They're going ahead with all sorts of programs to train the island's youth to have sort of certain vocational job skills that they can take when they move on to other parts of the world. And so there's kind of it's almost like an air of sort of sadness about the place, which is so different than what I recalled from a decade ago. So, anyone else? Yeah. Everybody stays for now, for the most part. Nobody really leaves Kiribati willingly. Kiribati is sort of a, it's like a big family, the entire nation. I mean, everybody's sort of intertwined and related in one way or another. And so there never has been sort of a mass emigration, which is, I find, really remarkable, because Kiribati is a really difficult place to live. I mean, it's extremely remote. It's your food sources are really, really limited. Healthcare is really, really basic. It's a difficult, but there's never been sort of a mass movement to emigrate. And so still today, there is no sort of, you know, urge, you know, hunger to sort of move on. In fact, I've met people there, like a good friend of mine. If anybody read The Sex Lives of Cannibals, it was Atenas. She was a gardener at the garden that my wife ran. She was in Australia for 3 years, and she despised it. She hated it. She said, sort of, you know, here, you know, I talk to my neighbors, and she goes, hey, neighbor. And all of a sudden, like, six voices bellow out of the bush, you know, and everybody's friendly and laughing. In Australia, nobody smiles and nobody laughs and whatnot. It's home, you know, for these people. And the rest, because it is so unique, the rest of the world is a scary place in some ways. You know, it's very cold and strange and difficult. So there is no desire to emigrate. But though it's curious, though, what I did find interesting, what I learned this time, is that the recent sort of science about sort of the expulsions and the exploration of the Pacific, like the first Pacific Islanders and how they traveled forth through the Pacific, you know, for a long time was sort of thought that, you know, people emigrated from sort of Taiwan, eventually making it to Samoa, and Samoa was sort of like the launching pad to go to the rest of the Pacific, particularly to the Marquesas and Tahiti and even in Kiribati. And now the recent thinking is that sort of it was different. The people emigrated, this would be 1,000 years ago, via Kiribati. So 1,000 years ago, people were kind of eager to leave. Not so much today. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of played up, you know, how they were great at playing and the great dance that there was at the end.
Right.
Did they kind of get with the program or something?
Now, he's that man, President Sito, that's what I was referring to in the first book. He's now the opposition leader. And since then, there's a new president who's been really terrific on sort of the climate change front. And also reining in and fighting sort of, you know, the island-style corruption. And he's been terrific. I mean, he's you know, you never hear of him out here because, you know, it's Kiribati. It's just a tiny little voice. But he's bellowing from the tops of the coconut trees that, you know, the island is sinking. And he's making sort of plans accordingly. Whereas President Sito, the opposition leader, who was the president while I was there, he's of the God will take care of it, very much so. God will not forsake us and that kind of thing, which under the circumstances is a very risky, I think, course of action. So he was just elected to another term 2 years ago, so he'll still be president for another 2-3 years. We'll see what happens. Yep.
With all the travel that you've done and seeing life from so many different perspectives in the world, what would you say is your most treasured experience?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard one. I mean, I don't know if I sort of look at it as sort of an accumulation of treasured experiences. I mean, those are things that I think sort of happen sort of accidentally even. You know, I mean, because that's life. You know, when you think back to what's really good in life, it's rarely is it planned or sort of searched for. It's just things that sort of happen. And so I think what I like to do is I like to go to places, new places in particular, and just go, I have no idea what's going on. And I know that just sort of hanging out for 4 or 5 days isn't going to tell me diddly. So just sort of spend the time and just try to sense, what is this place? Who are these people? What's their thinking? You know, how does it differ from what I'm familiar with? And just kind of sort of take things organically. But yeah, you know, you have sort of, when you travel around like that, you have extraordinary experiences. I mean, you know, when I was just reading here, I was just thinking of sort of being on sort of this homemade boat made out of plywood, painted a banana yellow, that basically when the tide was streaming in, we were essentially moving backwards. I mean, the distance between Tarawa and Abayang is not far, but it took the entire day to do that. But then sort of traveling, you know, with the dolphins and then sort of crossing sort of this magical barrier from ocean into lagoon, you know, going through the channel and seeing sort of the color of the water. I mean, it's hard to believe that these colors actually exist in the real world. And just thinking, you know, and then looking around and seeing sort of the curve of the atoll, curving sort of like a snake around a jewel, and being so far away from, you know, this world, and being on, you know, among these, you know, interesting, fascinating people, and knowing also that these places are going to disappear. It's just a really sort of, you know, special moment. And then it's, of course, you know, the people that you meet. When you're out and about, I mean, you have no idea who you're going to run into on any given day. And then it's like, you know, doing knuckleheaded things, like getting crooked tattoos that will not wash away. So, there you go. Anybody else? Oh, sorry. Yeah.
On your second visit to Kiribati, the most recent one, La Macarena, there's still their thing?
No, I was actually sort of, you know, I was thinking like, if La Macarena's there, I was actually really worried. I was sort of like, if I hear peep of like Justin Bieber, I'd know that the end was nigh. No, I didn't hear that. But what was interesting is sort of like a lot of people were talking about sort of the youth, you know, the late teens, 20-somethings, and how they seem to be kind of lost. Because, you know, with the passing of the years, they too get a little more of sort of the outside of the continental culture. But for me, it was sort of hard to distinguish because, you know, that's what people said when I lived there. And I'm sure that's what people said, you know, after World War II when, you know, the U.S. Army was there. And I'm sure that was said, you know, when Stevenson was there and the missionaries came in and all that kind of stuff. An older generation always talking about a younger generation lost. And we've been doing that since the beginning of time. So it's hard to know, but, you know, the young people that are in Kiribati now, should they grow to sort of, you know, old age, they're not going to die in their country. They have to move. But I worry that, you know, because you do have communities in the Pacific, particularly in like Auckland, New Zealand, you know, there's a huge Pacific Island community there, and the islanders get lost, you know, and they become sort of, you know, very gang infested and all that kind of thing. So who knows what the future is going to be for them. Anyone else? Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your time in Prague.
No, yeah. Well, I used to live in Prague. This is back during the glory days. I moved to Prague in 1992. But I'd been there before because I'm half Czech. I'm half Dutch, half Czech. That's my background. I was born in Holland. And my parents married before 1968, before the Soviet invasion. So my mother sort of got out kind of legally, and my grandfather still lived in Prague throughout that area. So I often visited when I was a kid in the 70s, and that was sort of like during the real dark time in Prague. But then after the wall crumbled, I was just planning on going for the summer. My grandmother was staying there, and I just slept in her kitchen. And then I heard about this English language newspaper, the Prague Post. So I kind of wandered in and immediately got a job and started writing for the Prague Post. And then I was like, okay, well, that's it. Forget about grad school. Forget about it, you know. I mean, it's Prague in the early 90s. It's incredibly cheap. Like, beer cost a nickel. Everything, you know. It's sort of, there's this extraordinary time in history. And, you know, somebody's asking me to be, like, a journalist and, like, write about it? How crazy is that? And so I took full advantage of it, and I traveled from Russia to Poland, and then, you know, I like a dumbass, I got a press pass and went to Bosnia. I mean, oh, I know, talking about being totally over my head. And, you know, it's the middle of a war. I always remember sort of arriving, I traveled to Mostar, which is a really, really bleak place during the war in Bosnia. And I got in there through a refugee bus, and the only way I got there is because I had these little press passes, and we got through all the military checkpoints. And then I arrived in Mostar, and of course I don't know anybody, I don't know where I'm doing, I have no idea what's going on, and I hop off, and I've got like my little backpack, and you know, I'm 23 years old, I'm just a kid, and all of a sudden I hear like all these booming explosions, I hear the gunfire all around me, the entire city has been leveled, essentially, and this guy drives up to me, and he looks at me, and he just tells me to get in, and he looks at me, and he goes, you are aware there is a war, yes? Yeah, you know, yeah, saw that. And then so he takes me to the Bosnian Army HQ, because it's the only place to go, to stay. And so I'm with the Bosnian Army, and unbeknownst to me, that's where all the mercenaries are staying, too. And so these mercenaries are sort of checking me out, and they say, well, do you think I can stay here? When they're English and Scottish and Canadian and whatnot. This is just not my natural milieu. it was an extraordinary time, and it was just, you know, a moment in history to be in that part of the world during 92 and 93. And then I moved back to DC after that, and of course, like, you do something like that for a couple of years where you're traveling to Russia and you're working at the Prague Post and, you know, you're in the war zone, and then you go to frickin' DC, it was like, and I think that really sort of exacerbated my wanderlust ever since, because it was just sort of hard to transition back to that. So maybe I was being a little childish at the time, but no, it was a great time. I look back upon that as just such a special time in my life. So lucky me. Yeah.
Did you help create any kind of tourism boom for Kiribati?
You know, I think a place like here, it's really hard to get to. And the air links are a little better now. There's a regular weekly flight that comes up now. But there's not a tourist on board. I remember when I was flying, I found, you know, I had to travel from Tahiti to New Zealand to Fiji just to catch a flight to Kiribati. It's just hard to get there. And as soon as I got there, I had a ticket, and it said, like, the flight would leave at 8:30 in the morning. So I get to the airport at, like, 6, and then the counterperson says that, oh, they decided to leave early. The plane left at 5:30. And so I had a week to kill in Fiji. You know, I was just goes, oh, we'll go whenever, whatever. So anyway, I came back. I caught, you know, the next week, the following week, I came back to the airport, and this time I just camped out at the airport. There was no way some, you know, eager beaver pilot is leaving without me. And the guy sitting next to me was a foreigner, and just kind of unusual. So I got to talk about it, and I turned to him, he's an older gentleman, and I turned to him and I said, so what brings you to Kiribati? And he was sort of like, he had kind of a strange Australian-French accent, if you can imagine such a thing. And he goes, I come for the leprosy and the tuberculosis. And he made it sound of like, kind of sound like a spa treatment. You know, some people come for like the enzyme peel, other people come for sort of like, you know, the leprosy tuberculosis with the cholera thrown in for free. and then I said, oh, so because I knew leprosy was still an issue when I was there. And I said, oh, you know, is leprosy still a big problem? And he goes, oh, yeah, it's a big problem. And then he starts coughing and sneezing violently, you know. And I said, oh, you know, it's interesting. I said, ask him, how do you catch, you know, leprosy these days? And he starts sneezing. It's like the spray going all over the place. And he goes, it's in the air. And I'm like saucer-eyed, you know. And he goes, but you have to have a certain gene to catch it. And, you know, I've been treating leprosy for 40 years and I've never got it. And I looked at him and he's all like gnarled and misshapen. And, you know, but no, so you don't get tours in Kiribati. And I don't think I've done much on that end. I mean, there really can't be more than 100 or two every year. You know, it was a great moment in my life. This is one of those magical moments in life that I went to the library, their national library, which is, you know, you can only imagine, it's just a tiny little thing. Mostly sort of done with like donated National Geographics from England from like the 1940s. It's kind of the library there. But they had sort of under a glass display, they had like all the books about Kiribati. And they had mine. And I was very excited. So I asked this if I could read it. And it was the best because I opened it up and it was inscribed by some Peace Corps volunteer from years ago. And he did it in this really flowery prose, like, because he was donating it to a former president of the country and all that. And I just, oh, gosh, life was just good sometimes, you know? I really like that. So, yeah. Okay, well, thanks so much for coming out. I enjoyed it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.